Renegade University is not only nonpartisan, we also teach courses that the regular universities are too afraid to. So coming up, we have two webinars that you'll never see being taught simultaneously at any school. We have the great sexologist Carol Queen's A World of Desires, Sexual Diversity in the Postmodern Age. That's coming up at the end of June. Go to renegadeuniversity.com/courses to sign up now. At the very same time, we will also be hosting Daniel McCarthy, arguably the leading conservative scholar in this country, who will be teaching a 5-part webinar on conservatism. Again, go to renegadeuniversity.com/courses to sign up for both of these amazing and, I would think, not contradictory in some ways, courses. I'll see you in class. But the other thing I want to tell you about is our unbelievable Renegade University weekend in Lockhart, Texas, on the weekend of October 8th to the 10th. Go to renegadeuniversity.com/Texas to get your tickets now. The VIPs, I believe we have one left, but the general admissions, there are still plenty for you. And you will have access at that weekend to Scott Horton, Jack the Perfume Nationalist, Hotep Jesus, Cody Wilson, Deirdre McCluskey, Buck Johnson, and me. Go to renegadeuniversity.com/Texas and get your tickets before it sells out. And I hope to see you in Lockhart, which is the barbecue capital of Texas as well. Thanks. Thanks to Brightside for sponsoring Unregistered. Brightside offers personalized, life-changing anxiety and depression care from your own home. Take your free mental health assessment and get up to $100 credit on your first month of treatment at brightside.com/renegade. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. My guest this week has devoted much of his adult life to personal liberty, while at the same time being devoted to and loving a career of saving people's lives that unfortunately has been monopolized by the government since the 19th century. How do you remain committed to freedom in a world that doesn't allow it? This is my interview with Buck Johnson. I am joined from Lockhart, Texas, the site of the upcoming Renegade University weekend in Texas, in Lockhart, Texas, by Buck Johnson, the host of the Counterflow podcast, which is a member of the Renegade Media Network, as your announcer says so powerfully on your show, Buck. Just want to tell people the story about how I know you, which it's only been, what, like 6 months or so?
No, I bet you it's been close to a year now if you think about you being on Death to Tyrants.
That's right. So Buck had me on his show. I didn't know who he was. I was like, oh, another libertarian podcast for me to be on. Okay, fine. And because I've been on about 150 of those. So, you know, and they're always fine and fun. But I was on your show and I just, as I told you at the time, and as anybody who listens to it can find out, there was something about you that
opened me up, and I was saying a lot of stuff that I'd never said before in public, and I was saying just a lot of things that I'd never even thought before. And there was something about your manner, demeanor, and your interviewing style that I thought was just really effective, at least for me. And so I started to say, hey, man, I want to start a podcast network with Unregistered, and I want you to be the first member. And so we've been working on it, and or we were working on it, and it was Death to Tyrants, and then it became Counterflow, and it's the most beautifully branded podcast out there, and it is still hosted by my second favorite podcast host, Buck Johnson. So, Buck, tell us about your podcast and what it means to you, you know?
Yeah, I can, you like the name or how I got that?
All in, no, like, you know, my podcast is like my baby. It means a lot to me. I have feelings, intense feelings about it. And I'm sure you do about yours, right?
Yes. It's, I say a labor of love, because if we're using the Marxist style economics, I'm not making as much as I should for the amount of time that I'm putting into it. You know, the labor and the labor and value and all of this stuff. Yep. I say that kind of jokingly, but yeah, it's every day. I was talking to my wife yesterday, or actually today, about, imagine if I had a job where I worked from home. And she said, you kind of do. Like, on your days off, you're in your office all day, except for when I go to the gym. I'm working on reaching out to people, researching people, reading up their material, writing up kind of interview notes, stuff like that. So yeah, it's I love it.
Yeah. And it's a political podcast.
Yeah. For the most part, I've dipped my toe into lifestyle stuff. I had a doctor on that promotes the carnivore diet. I've had, in the past, I had Tim Kennedy on, who kind of a lifestyle guy, although we did talk politics.
He's the MMA fighter from the UFC fighter. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. He is a badass.
And a former, was he a SEAL? What was he? Special forces of some sort?
Yes. Of some sort. Yeah. He still does all that. And he basically runs these classes that teach you self-defense, and he's got different levels. So some armed, some not. Basically, I just want to see Antifa go after that guy while he's at a restaurant. It would just it'd be wonderful. So yeah, for the most part, I do stick to politics because I'm obsessed with politics. I read about it, I watch it, I listen to other podcasters talk about politics. And some people say it's a waste of time. It's not really going to affect your everyday life. You could just go out and just live life. I think I do that, but I just can't get away from the politics either.
Me neither, man. It's a lifetime affliction, you know? Mm-hmm. And it is, we all know it's not healthy for us mentally, although sometimes it's a lot of fun. A lot of times it's a lot of fun and very gratifying, but it's also a source of tremendous angst. I mean, in my personal life, I was just telling you, I had a huge blow up with my parents just the other night, and that was over. I mean, it was over everything, but politics was the proximate cause of it. We got into a fight, and they're big fans of MSNBC, and they call Rachel Maddow by her first name and Kamala Harris by her first name. And so you can imagine.
Did you tell him you call Steve Bannon by his?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. This is not the first time I've had a conflict like this in my life. I've lost friends. I've lost many friends over politics. I should say they lost me, right? Because they chose to make politics an issue between us, where it wasn't for me. I didn't mind that we disagreed about climate change, you know, but they did. It was really offensive to them, and they just simply couldn't be friends with me any longer because of my ideas about climate change, which, you know, I think that says something about the left, don't you think?
Left, yes, psychology. It does. Yes, extremely, because like you said, they left me basically. I've had a few I lost over this last year, 2020, and I've been accused of being a proud boy. And, you know, those type of insults. And it's like, you could text me. You don't have to call me out on Facebook, on social media. You're my friend. You could text me and go, hey, I just had a disagreement with your politics, but they don't want to do that part of it because there's no one else sees you do that. It's got to be a virtue signal to other people that are in their mindset. And the leftism is a totalitarian supremacist mindset, meaning you can't think your own thing, Thad. if I don't like what you think and I'm on the left, I've got to change it for you, or I don't want you in my life. Yeah. Which is, it's funny when you see Alabama or Georgia maybe go to the right some on their abortion laws, California flips out, Hollywood flips out. They threaten, we're not going to film movies if you guys do that down in Georgia. This is the only time ever leftists will pretend to even care about what Southerners do, is if they go move to the right on a law. Mm.
So you're sounding like you're not a leftist.
No.
People are figuring this out now. Yeah. So your politics, how would you describe them?
I think labels have been so muddied and such a gray area, but I think I could say paleo libertarian would signal enough commonality with where people understand what I'm trying to get at with that label. Because if you just say libertarian, it's way too muddied at this point. And yeah. so to put the term paleo in front of it, I think at least gives people the idea that I would be considered a right-leaning libertarian.
So, okay. So paleo means what for you?
It basically means right-wing libertarianism in the mold of Rothbard towards the end of his life, certainly. Most of his life, if you take out the 60s, I would say Rothbard was a right-wing libertarian. Lou Rockwell, Hans Hermann Hoppe, people like that.
Okay, so let's talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean about how you're different from other libertarians?
Well, one of the ways is that libertarians like to say we're neither left nor right. And really, libertarianism is a very thin, purposely thin philosophy. It just means the non-aggression principle. That's really it. So to just say that's my life, hey, I believe in the NAP, non-aggression principle, and that's what makes me who I am. Well, there's so many other things. So I believe that libertarians, they're better off giving themselves the labels of left or right, because that explains a lot more of their lifestyle, we can say. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of left libertarians, you know, you know them. I know some of them, the Reason people. They celebrate sex work and drug culture and things like that. And while obviously I'm not for laws against any of that stuff, celebrating it is something that I don't do.
Okay. You know that I've had like 7 or 8 sex workers on my show.
I know. As I was saying that, I'm thinking that hates what I'm saying right now. But
I don't hate it.
No, I'm just giving you a hard time. But yeah, it's just that I think that celebrating drug culture and sex culture and it doesn't do libertarians any favors. I think we can all, it's like good discussions to have. I would never put a prostitute in prison or jail of any sort. I wouldn't make, there'd right. be no laws against it. But certainly in a true, if we had our utopia of an ANCAP society, I think it'd be a lot of small sections, and there'd be some that would be ultra strict, and they would have rules at least in their little community against sex work. And then there'd be some that kind of anything goes.
So why, and I'm not going to fight you on this, I just want to know what your position is. So what is it about sex work and drugs that are not okay?
I think, I don't know even if I like the term not okay, but I think it would be dishonest of me personally to celebrate it, because what I want a daughter very bad. We don't have one yet, but I want one. And it would be if someone said, oh, that's really cool to you. Would you like your daughter to be a prostitute? No, I would not. Would I like my wife to go do that on the side? No.
Okay.
So it's just not an appropriate thing for my particular life.
I'm going to keep pushing you. I'm not arguing. I'm just trying to get you to flesh out your own ideas on this. Right.
Okay.
And you know, you've heard me say this, right? Someone's values I consider to be sovereign. So like, once you tell me very clearly what your value is, that's kind of the end of the discussion. Like, I'm not going to try to persuade you that what you value is the wrong thing to value. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Why? I mean, this is a funny question on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's actually, there's a lot more to it than meets the eye, right? Why exactly would you not want your daughter or your wife to be sex workers?
Because You might have just tapped into something, because I know how the men are that would be not taking advantage of them, but that would be participating. Maybe we could say
the Johns. You're talking about the clients.
No, yeah, the clients.
Yeah.
Because I was a young, wild man, and I would not want to see my daughter or wife, or if I had a sister, I kind of do. We'll get into that later. Joking. I would not want to see them one-on-one with people that take part in that kind of stuff.
Oh, so it's that they come into contact with men you find to be completely unsavory.
Yes.
And you're assuming that the clients of sex workers are like that generally, that they're unsavory men the way that you,
and it's hard to say. Yeah. And it's hard to say sex workers, that's so broad, but like we were talking before we started recording, the last time I was in a strip club was with a couple friend of mine and everyone's just drinking and, you know, there just to have fun and kind of be goofy. And I'm watching this group of men, just the way they were acting towards the strippers. And it just was kind of disgusted me. And I told my wife, I said, I can't believe of all people now me has this attitude, like this is gross in here. And it's just kind of turned me off. And they just look like out of shape losers. I was like, this is so gross. Let's go.
So
just that vibe kind of grosses me out.
Yeah. Okay. So like they become like degraded by the contact with the already degraded men.
Yes. And the women that I know and have known that have been in and around that type of work, this is not a blanket judgment on everyone that does it, if for those listening, but there's just a lot of issues, a lot of upstairs issues, and they're trying to manifest themselves and through some, you know, I just want them to feel that they can be better than doing stuff like that.
Oh,
I don't want them to go to jail.
So Maggie McNeil will be at your house tomorrow. She has some things to say to you.
Oh
no, I think that's fine. There's no point in arguing. If someone believes that, I guess that's the end of the conversation, you know?
No, I'm open to it. I'm curious.
No.
Thoughts there.
No. I mean, all I ever do is I just want people to understand why they're opposed to things, you know? What is it about this? And that was actually interesting. I've never heard that. That's an interesting, and I think that's probably common. I bet a lot of men feel that way about it.
Mm-hmm.
That they assume the men involved are disgusting and they don't want their women to be associated with men like that. And to have sex with men like that is the worst possible thing. It's the, it's almost like guilt by association or something, or,
because yeah, like I saw those strippers and these guys are just losers, and I wanted to go up to the strippers and go, these, you know, you can do something better than this. Look at these guys. Although like we also talked about, I don't think that it's the men taking advantage of the strippers when you go to a strip club. Like that's kind of the common, I think it's a common misconception within society. The strippers have all the power.
Yep.
They're above the men. These guys are just shelling out these dollars. You know, they don't have a lot of them. And the women are just raking it all in because they're like a beauty queen to these guys.
Yeah. So why wouldn't you want your wife to do that?
Oof. Cause I just would seeing the guys are such.
Yeah. But she's being worshiped as a goddess, and they can't even touch her if she doesn't want it.
Well, right? They do.
They do touch.
Oh yeah.
I've never been to a strip club. I don't exactly know what goes on.
Yeah, they do. And there's always boundaries that are being pushed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay. Yeah. That's really interesting. So in a sense, it's like you're being a little bit rivalrous with those men, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Cool. Dude, that's awesome. I mean, that's like, you're very clear about it. And there's no point in getting into like whether that's rational or what that means about you. It's just, that's your feeling. That's your feeling. Mm-hmm. And you know it now. Now you know where it comes from. Drugs. Why? What's wrong with drugs, Buck?
Yeah, I nothing really. When I said that, I really mean it's not doing libertarians any favor.
Yes.
To focus on that.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's more of a strategic
idea,
really, because there's really nothing wrong with drugs, in my opinion. Okay. I mean, we all know that they could kill you, but I'm drinking a beer right now. Right. So could any of these. So I don't really have an issue. You know, if my friends, I've been very open with them that smoke weed, that they're more than welcome to smoke it in my house. I don't smoke it because of my job, but it doesn't bother me at all.
Okay, good. Because I will be smoking a lot of weed in your house in October.
Yes.
When we have our Renegade University weekend there. So, all right. Now, another thing people don't know about you yet is that you're a firefighter, and we can't say which department, but we can say it's a major city department.
We can say it's a major city. Yes.
Yeah.
We just which one?
Major city fire department. And you've been, I don't even know this. How long have you been a firefighter?
In July, it will be 23 years.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
So that means this has been your whole career. You've never done anything else.
Correct.
How old were you when you started?
So to answer your question fully, it's more than 23 years. When I was 19, I started in one fire department for about a year and a half. And then when I was 21, I started in the one that I'm in currently. And I've been in this one for 23 years. So basically it went from 19 years old till I'm 44 now. That's all I've ever known.
19. So yeah. So instead of college, that's what you did.
I did a little piece of college, community college, because kind of the old thing, like you got to go to college, you're out of high school. And I did the basics or whatever. And I took a sex class. They actually had a trans person talk to us in 1997.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't want to go off on that tangent, but yeah, I was going to be what I thought was a criminal psychologist. And after I started asking myself multiple classes in, what is that? And I realized, I'm not sure what it is. Why am I doing this? So I took a law class, a law kind of police related class, and a psychological sex class of some sort. And then they had a fire academy at that college I was going to. Huh. So I put myself through that.
And so you and I have never really talked about this.
Right.
Tell me about it, man. Like, what was it? What was that like? What was your first experience with it like? And why did it turn you on so much?
The fire department stuff?
Yeah. Being a firefighter. Like,
so every man on my mom's side of the family for the last probably 100 years were firefighters.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
100 mm-hmm. years. Wow.
Yes. If I would have gotten into the fire department that they were all a part of, I won't say the name either, but it would have, my family would have been in for over 100 years, and I broke it by joining another one. But I was just driving one day because I was a musician through high school, and I did play enough right when I was done with high school to at least make money for an 18-year-old. And I told myself, I'm not going to have another job outside of playing music unless it's a career. I'm not just going to go bounce to an office and then do this thing and then sales or something. I'm only going to have a career, and up until then I'm going to play music. Mm-hmm. And I thought, one day I was driving to see my grandparents, and I was like, huh, he was a firefighter. That seems like a cool job. I had never even thought about it before that. And really? It's funny how the history is all through my mom's side of the family. I had never been to a fire station. I had never talked to my grandfather or my uncle about their jobs ever.
Really?
Yeah. And on that trip, when I thought about it, we got down there, and I just brought it up, and my grandfather said, "Oh, it's the best job in the world. You should do it." And my mom, you know, immediately was like, "Yes, please. That's a great job." And they all kept talking the retirement. Yeah. And so, I said, okay. And you'll get a kick out of this. I started a private fire academy, which most cities put you through their own fire academy. Mm. But this was at San Antonio College at the time, the junior college. They had one. So I put myself through it. They give you a uniform, and day one, you have to show up in it. You go get it prior. I showed up in my uniform. I was a full-on rockabilly kid. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
Yes, very much.
But I was playing I was playing in a rockabilly band, so I had a big pompadour and giant sideburns like down to my
Really?
And I walked in. Now, doing the job as long as I've done now, it just makes me cringe picturing the 19-year-old me walking into this fire academy on day one. Like, if it was one of my cadets, I'd just be like, what the fuck are you doing looking like this? But I walked in with my pompadour all greased back on the sides, and I had a chain wallet. I rolled my uniform pants up just a bit, and I rolled my sleeves up tight on the arms. I had a lot to learn.
Thank God, the mental health care profession has finally entered the digital age, and it is being led by Brightside.com. I strongly recommend, if you are suffering from what I suffer from, a lot of anxiety and depression, especially in the last couple of years, go to Brightside.com/renegade. And you can take a free mental health assessment and get $100 credit toward your first treatment. So definitely do that. When I started treatment 20 years ago, I just went to the local psychoanalytic shrink who was a Freudian. I spent 10 years and $40,000 on that. I came out of it feeling worse. My relationships were worse off. I did know a lot about my childhood, but that's all I got out of it. Now, Brightside, you go to their website and you get to choose from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of providers, of healthcare providers who can really help you, tailored to your own needs right now. And again, as I said, through this deal, by going to brightside.com/renegade, you'll get $100 off your first treatment. So do it now. Brightside is the future and the present, I think, of mental health in the country and perhaps in the world. So join thousands of Brightside members taking back their lives. Take your free mental health assessment and get up to $100 credit on your first month of treatment at brightside.com/renegade. Again, that's brightside.com/renegade. Brightside.com/renegade. I will be joining you on this journey. So check back in soon for reports on what I'm doing with Brightside. Thank you so much. That's beautiful. So I guess there will be some people in the audience who don't know what rockabilly means. I was in the sort of alt music scene back in the 1980s when rockabilly first happened, like Brian Setzer and all that stuff. But tell people what, and I had several friends who were in rockabilly bands, but how do you define it? What is rock? It's a really interesting, odd little subculture within music, right?
It is. Yes. And we'll get to why Counterflow later. Part of my life is a subculture. And so rockabilly is basically the early Elvis Presley from the Sun Records recordings. It's a mix of what really literally means hillbilly and rock and roll, rockabilly. And so it's got the big upright bass quite often and hollow body Gretsch electric guitars. And like you said, the resurgence of it was certainly in the 80s with Brian Setzer and the Stray Cats. So it's that kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And high energy, super high energy, right? The music.
Yes. Yeah. When I used to stand, I stood up while I played drums when I was in my first rockabilly band. I would stand on the drums. Yeah. I would light them on fire.
That's right. The drummers are always standing up in rockabilly bands. That's the other thing about them, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
So, okay. So, and you're a drummer. And I was a drummer in high school and college, but I was a shitty, shitty drummer. I was pretty much faking it, but I loved it. I've always loved rhythm. And it was the only instrument that I felt like I could intuitively play, you know, without training. Yeah. Like at all, you know?
Yes.
So, and I've always loved rhythm. When I listen to a song, I go straight for the drummer. Do you do that? Do you immediately listen for the drums in a song?
And bass, both. Yes.
And bass. Yeah. The section. Yeah.
Yep.
And how long you've been drumming, I assume, since you were a kid as well?
Yeah. Since I was about 9 or 10.
My. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about that. So you've been in a whole bunch of bands, right?
Yes. Throughout the years, I lived in Los Angeles when I was 9 or 10. And that's right when Poison, Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue were giant, especially in Los Angeles. They had all come off the Sunset Strip, excuse me.
Yep.
And I started seeing this on TV and I immediately saw Ricky Rocket, the drummer of Poison. And I was like, I want to be him. So we went and my parents got me drum lessons down the street there off of Laurel Canyon in San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
And I started doing that. God, I was terrible for a little while. But it afforded me a lot of amazing opportunities, though. Certainly when I was in my 20s, I got to go all around the country, the world, multiple festivals in other countries. That's what allowed me also to play for Ron Paul festivals multiple times. So that's when my worlds were kind of colliding. But yeah, the drumming stuff was great. And I didn't do much over 2020, but I'm still open to do some here and there when it's not one of the people that have written me off because of my politics wants me to play with them.
Yeah, right. So the genres, so rockabilly, and what else have you done? What other genres do you play?
Ska.
Do you know this? I was a ska mod when I was in high school.
Oh, really? Well, the term gets thrown around a lot and people don't know what it means, but I was an old skinhead into the ska stuff.
Yeah, totally. Oh my God. Yeah. That's so funny.
And for those listening, it's not a racist skinhead. Most of them aren't, but no. The media kind of takes that and runs with it.
Yeah. People don't know that the skinhead culture, which came over here from England, is divided. So there are like left-wing socialist skinheads, and there are right-wing Nazi skinheads, and there's all sorts of skinheads. But
yeah. And then there's just regular ones right in the middle that don't really buy into the politics of either side.
Was that you?
That was me. Yes.
Okay.
At the time, I was young.
Yeah. Ska. Yeah. So I was a ska mod. I wore black and white suits every day. And
I did not know this about you. How cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I had black and white bowling shoes.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I had a black and white fedora with a, you know, the white band and a black fedora hat. Yeah. Yes. I wore like little skinny black ties and black suits, white shirts. And I listened to the English Beat, the Specials, Selector, yada, yada, you know, the Jam, the Clash. That was my thing back in the 80s.
Yeah.
That was my whole crew, my whole scene. So ska, rockabilly, and punk, I'm assuming a little bit of punk here and there.
Yeah. I've played some punk bands. And then also the last 5 to 10 years. Oh shit. Yeah. Geez. I've been in Austin, near Austin for 20 years almost. Yeah. Rockabilly and mainly like classic country.
Okay.
Throughout the, and in Austin, those two scenes are very much incestuous and kind of overlap.
So what are the biggest bands you played with?
The biggest would probably be Jimmy Vaughn, as far as actually me playing drums for the artist. That's Stevie Ray Vaughan's brother, for those that don't know that. He's a legend around in Texas for sure.
Yeah.
And I played with him because he's a giant Ron Paul guy.
No shit.
I was friends with him already, and he didn't want to take his regular band to go do the events for Ron Paul. So he picked me and my buddies who played in a band already together, and we were called the Horton Brothers. And he said, I'll just take the Horton Brothers. We'll play all the Ron Paul stuff. It was when in 07, when that Ron Paul revolution was ramping up, the energy around Texas was huge for that. So it was awesome. We went up to Minneapolis and, you know, and all the while in his tour bus. And it was something else. Then we went down to Florida. It was awesome.
Ron Paul and rock and roll don't really go together in my mind. You know, my whole problem with like a lot of libertarians, especially of that ilk, it's not the policy. Like, I agree with Ron Paul on like 98% of policy. They're so square. Like, it's ridiculous how like uptight and square they are and repressed. And I actually think that comes from classical liberalism, but that's a longer conversation. But I mean, tell me, so you're in the music scene, you're in not just the music scene, but you're in kind of the subculture wing of the music scene. You're in these subcultures that are pretty wild and aggressive in a way, right? And very flamboyant, you know, the styles, the dress, the music is all very flamboyant, the tattoos. And they also, musicians like artists, like poets, like intellectuals, tend overwhelmingly to be left wing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like culturally, there's a lot of freedom there, I guess. Maybe. I mean, that's how I see it. You could also say
prior to 2020.
Oh, okay. I want to hear about that. But I mean, you know, there's people are allowed to express themselves in all sorts of ways that they're not allowed to express themselves in like your typical Republican town in Alabama.
Correct.
Okay, good. There are things about conservatism that I don't like. I'm establishing that right now, right? So
yeah.
And in fact, I think left-wing politics, and this is kind of what I'm sure you've heard me talk about a lot, is actually in conflict with that kind of cultural freedom, because socialism and even progressivism require sacrifice of ourselves for the greater good, for the community, for the state. I'm just kind of talking here. I just want to get your feelings, because you're someone who's been in these worlds that are so goddamn different, right? So you've got these basically punk rock types, right, who you're dealing with in your music world. You got firefighters. That's an entirely different, that's a yet another culture. I don't even know what that culture is. I'd love to hear. And then you got libertarians you've been hanging out with. Well, we haven't even mentioned one thing. So you're named after, I guess, the most famous conservative in American history, right?
I guess he is. He's the most hated by my brand of conservatism. That's the whole irony.
Joe Buck, the baseball commentator. No, just kidding. Yes. You're named after William F. Buckley.
Yes, basically. It cringes. I cringe just saying it, but I am. And Rothbard hated him. He hated Rothbard.
I know.
Too, of course. And all of the good conservative right wingers just didn't like William F. Buckley. And I'm on their side, but I was named after him. Damn it. My brother's named after Barry Goldwater. I would have taken that instead.
Because your dad was a big, oh, wow. Check it out. So he's showing a Goldwater. Was Miller? Who was his running mate? I don't even know this. Who was Goldwater's running mate? Who was Miller?
I guess that guy. I should know this because I've read his biography, but
I should know this because I'm an American historian. Joe is showing a Goldwater election campaign pin for those listening. So your dad was a big, like, right wing, obviously Republican type.
Yes, still is.
And still is. And that's what you were raised around.
Till I was about 10 when they split up, because then we moved out of state. And obviously my dad's influence was still there. We saw him regularly, I wasn't immersed in that. Mm-hmm. And so really it's interesting. My teenage years, where you kind of start forming more of your just kind of opinions and analysis on society. And I was not with my father. I was with my stepfather and mom. And so I think that kind of swayed me away from leaning right through my 20s, because like when I was a early libertarian, I would say that I was a kind of blue-pilled, left-leaning, reasonite type libertarian, which fit my lifestyle at the time.
Yeah, totally. I was going to say that. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why you've become paleo, because you're a musician covered in tattoos.
Yeah, but I'm old and married and want small town life and want the left to leave me the hell alone.
Is it really about the change in the way you're living? So you recently moved from the city where you're a firefighter to Lockhart, which is a small town south of Austin. And it's kind of idyllic, and you're married. Is that really why you're now paleo and don't like left-wing cultural stuff?
I don't think that I would say that's why. I think my lifestyle, it's almost like as you age and develop and evolve with, and as the society around you starts to change, which it did giantly in 2020, you start to see what's more valuable and what you don't want to be a part of anymore. And so the whole time, of course, I'm interviewing people from Mises and reading further and always trying to explore more ideas, until I came upon this paleo libertarian strategy from the 1990s. And after reading all these pieces from Rothbard and Rockwell, I thought, I guess this is a better way to describe me these days.
Now, wait a second. So the paleo strategy of Rothbard, I mean, are we talking about his courtship of the super far right, like back in
Patrick
the 90s?
Bannon? Yes, this is my favorite. That's my favorite Rothbard.
Oh, wow. So you're talking about like the David Duke stuff.
Yes, but that insult gets thrown out he was not saying I like everything about David Duke.
I know.
Yes, but it is that stuff.
But it was an alliance. It was a coalition with.
He just wrote a piece defending him. I don't think that he ever met him.
Gotcha. Okay. But I mean, I don't know this. What did Rothbard say was the strategy? Like, what was he trying to accomplish?
So the paleo strategy was basically a withdrawal from the LP. It's very, it's interesting because
Libertarian Party.
Yeah. Sorry for just throwing that out there at Libertarian Party. If you read those pieces now, which my friend Tho Bishop has gotten the permission from Lou Rockwell to republish all of these over the next year, boy, it relates to right now, the time and the place that we're in politically, because Rothbard was basically saying the Libertarian Party is full of a bunch of jokers and losers, and they're not doing anything. They've never done anything. They've been in the same spot, just spinning their wheels decade after decade. And all they're celebrating is stuff that mainstream culture, mainstream voters don't care about. In other words, back then, it just the hippie aspect of libertarianism was just not appealing to your average voter. And so he said they were culturally right anyway, Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard. You know what? The right wing, these guys with Patrick Buchanan after the Cold War and everything has gone, and Vietnam and all of this. Wait a second. They're not overseas interventionists anymore. They don't want to fight wars. This segment of the right.
Yes.
Wait a second. They actually align with what we're saying. They're just culturally conservative. Rothbard's saying, well, so am I. And so, and Ron Paul was part of this as well. And so rather than continue the wheel spinning that was just going on within the Libertarian Party, Rothbard broke apart and said, I'm done with this. I'm aligning myself. I'm going to endorse Patrick Buchanan for president. Here's why. And the kind of the meetings that happened through the years were basically, look, guys on the right, we agree with you on cultural issues. You've got to come our way a little bit on economics. Mm-hmm. And they did not in the end. And so that's ended up why it fell apart. Hans Hermann Hoppe had a nasty piece about Patrick Buchanan's economics. I believe there were some face-offs and whatnot. But
Okay. Thank you. We all know that people who are committed to personal liberty and freedom don't care about people, right? Well, that's not true. One great example is Paloma Verde CBD. .com, the wonderful company based in San Antonio, Texas, owned and operated by Carlos and Vanessa Abelar, who have been sponsors of this podcast for a year now. I am proud to say they are thriving and flourishing and adding new products and have a brand new website. So go to PalomaVerdeCBD.com to check all that out. It is beautiful and a beautiful thing. But ladies and gentlemen, if you have trouble with sleep, and I bet a lot of you do, because I do, I have something to tell you. They now have an amazing melatonin CBD hybrid formula here that I'm telling you will change your life. But also, in their store for unregistered listeners, that product and everything else is 25% off for us because we are special and because we have helped build that company. So again, go to PalomaVerdeCBD.com. Also, check out the Unregistered Combo Pack, which has my three favorite products I've talked about many times. They're gummies. Find me some gummies, CBD or THC, or even regular, just candy, that tastes better than candy. Here you go. 10 milligrams of CBD in each candy, by the way. Their tincture is my favorite thing. I'm going to talk about it second because it's my favorite thing. I've talked about it a lot. Fast-acting, high-potency tincture. You put some drops under your tongue and the anxiety and insomnia melt away real fast. This is your daily maintenance, I think. 25 milligrams of CBD per capsule, per soft gel, excuse me. They're CBD soft gels. I take several per day, depending on what's going on, and I highly recommend that. You get all three of those products in the Unregistered Combo Pack, also known as the THAAD Pack. And that is 33% off. So you just have to, in these days of anxiety, depression, insomnia for so many people, you just have to go to PalomaVerdeCBD.com and get those incredible deals. Your body's gonna feel better, your life's gonna be better, and I really thank you. So Pat Buchanan ran for president twice, right, in the 90s?
Mm-hmm.
And was it 96? What was the big famous speech? Was it 96?
Or 92 and 96 were the two.
I think it was 96. He gave like a really his most famous speech, I believe, at the RNC, I think. And I read his big book about immigration. I forget the name of it, but it's essentially a Trumpian type argument against immigration. However, there are sections in it where it's at least racist adjacent. It is, he's primarily concerned with the decline or replacement of traditional American culture by people who have different cultures from different parts of the world. And, and which is funny from an Irish American, you know, because the Irish were, you know, severely discriminated against in the 19th century. His ancestors were Papuchanans, but you know, he's a nationalist, right? There's a nationalism there. It's very Trumpian. It's sort of proto Trump, right? It's very nationalist. It is xenophobic in a sense, not in a stupid way, right? Xenophobia sort of means just you're afraid of anybody different. It's sort of a principled xenophobia in the sense that they believe, and this makes sense, right? On its own terms, that America is the best country on earth. It has the best culture in the history of the world. And therefore, if, you know, any influence from other countries is simply going to diminish the greatness of America. Logically, it's totally coherent, right? It's just that the question is, Buck Johnson, how much, and this goes for everybody, you have to answer this question, how attached are you to traditional American culture? What is it about American traditional American culture that you like and value and want to preserve?
So that's an easy one.
Go. Let's go.
The rebellious spirit.
Okay.
Because it's not in very many other first world countries. I've not traveled enough to third world, so I don't know for sure, but I noticed this throughout my touring years, and I still have very close friends in Europe. It's just not there. And it's so interesting. I remember on the road one time on tour, traveling in a van with Europeans. I had a book by Harry Brown called Why Government Doesn't Work. And I remember one of the Europeans just did not click. You would never think that.
Right.
And that rebellious, let me do it, I don't need your help spirit is uniquely American, in my opinion.
Well, you're talking about, there's plenty of rebelliousness in Europe, right? They're always rioting in the streets. It's the individualistic rebellion, right? That's what it is. It's the individual rebelling against norms and laws and rules, right? That's rock and roll.
Yeah.
That's jazz back in the day. That's blues. Yeah. That's punk rock. That's all of it. That's your tattoos on your biceps right now, you know? Right. And, okay. Well, that's not Pat Buchanan though.
Pat Buchanan is not my hero by any means. I just appreciated the libertarian part of aligning with someone, because Murray Rothbard's point also was we're not getting anyone elected that's a libertarian. So if we want to have serious progress in the political realm, we've got to align ourselves with one of the major parties, and it's certainly not going to be the Democratic one. And it won't be the Bush wing of the Republican one. So at least we've got this guy that's anti-war.
Okay.
And Pat Cannon.
That's what I was getting at.
A lot of the right-leaning libertarians kind of had an affection for Trump a bit, because at least he rhetorically was anti-war.
Sure. So Pat Buchanan has been consistently, much more than Trump, he's truly consistently, in a principled way, anti-war. I think it always, or at least has been for quite a while, since Vietnam. And in fact, Pat Buchanan once reprinted one of my articles about foreign policy on the front of his website, and I almost asked him to take it down.
I would be so honored.
I know. So here's the thing, Buck. So I was like thinking, you know, war is my number one issue. Like foreign policy, that's the thing I care about the most. I think it's the worst thing that governments and the state can do. And I do everything I can to stop us from having World War III. That's kind of my ongoing mission, you know? So I will absolutely join in coalition with communists who are anti-war at the moment. I will absolutely be in coalition with even liberals who are anti-war. If they're anti-war, there's fewer and fewer, but you know, if they, I will stand with them. of course, your typical libertarians are anti-war. So I've been standing with them for a long time. So then it came to me, like, Pat Buchanan, what do I do with Pat Buchanan, whose anti-war credentials are better than Bernie Sanders's credentials? I mean, his anti-war credentials are damn near perfect for, you know, most of my lifetime. How am I supposed to say no to being associated with Pat Buchanan? Why would I want my article to be taken down from his website? And here's the answer. The motivation, his motivation for being anti-war is xenophobic and, if not racist, real, real close. I happen to love the multiplicity of cultures around the world. This is what I love about, one of the things I love about America, as do many people, is we are a nation of immigrants. I love the diversity of cultures here. Travel, you know this, since you've traveled around the world, you go to other countries with the exception of, you know, a handful, that you just will not see anywhere near the kind of diversity we have here. Mm-hmm. Which is wonderful. We can eat any kind of food in America. You can't do that anywhere else in the world.
That's for sure.
Any kind of food, even in Texas, you can get any kind of food. No offense. Certainly in Austin.
Even in Texas, yes.
You know what I mean? I mean, you can get European, you can get French food, you can get Japanese food, you can get Malaysian food. It's all there. And then, of course, all of our different ethnicities here have, well, I don't need to go on. People know what I'm talking about. But that's the beauty of it. Now, historically, I didn't know this until I started researching the book I'm working on now, but probably the leading anti-imperialists, like the loudest, most effective anti-imperialists in American history, early on in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, were segregationist racist senators. For the reason that Pat Buchanan is against war and imperialism, because once you establish an empire, especially an empire in third world countries, well, the next thing you know, now you have sovereignty over those people, and now they are living under the same roof, essentially, politically speaking, as us. And you get more race mixing, and you get, you know, all of a sudden there's Filipinos in the United States after we invaded the Philippines. And oh my God, you know, and look at the history of the British Empire. I mean, go to London and you will see, like, people, you know, London is full of people from the empire, not from England.
Right. Yeah.
So that was, I know that was the reason for a lot of anti-imperialists to be anti-imperialist in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And it's pretty clear, I think, that's at least a major reason that Buchanan is opposed to war too. He doesn't want to do the mixing that's involved with war and empire.
I'll take it. I mean, that's not my reason.
Yeah, but no, I know.
If we have the same goals, I'm not sure why, you know, we can have different reasons for them. But it's interesting because you said he was more consistent than Donald Trump's. No doubt about that. And yeah. Trump's anti-imperialism doesn't have anything to do with that, I don't think, the way I read it.
Right.
It's all about, he looks at it from a financial aspect and he's like, this is a waste of money. What are you guys, idiots? You know, he's looking at it like a guy who's run a bunch of businesses before.
It is. Yeah, you're right. He is very concerned about the balance sheet. Right. Talking about like how stupid it was to let them keep the oil, for instance. Right. Yeah. But I think for Trump, it's also it's very McCainian in the sense that it's about national pride for him. Right. I think he's very concerned. He fetishizes the military. And I think he sees it as an unacceptable attack on American national pride and identity for things like ISIS to take control of a big chunk of the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, for John McCain to get shot down, right? Like, you know, that's why he had to go out of his way to make fun of McCain. He wants America to win. He wants America to be great again. He wants America to be dominant again. He doesn't like losing like in Vietnam. I mean, I think now that could have actually been what he was really saying when he was talking about McCain getting shot down and being a loser. The Vietnam War was a loser's war.
Yes.
I'm hoping that's what Trump sort of in the back of his head was thinking. But and then, yeah, his whole critique of the Iraq War, which is pretty spot on, is both. It's like, we lost a lot. We lost a ton of money in fighting it, he said many, many times. And also we lost opportunities to make money from it. We could have taken their oil.
Yeah.
But also it embarrassed the United States to the world. We became the laughing stock because everybody was like, what the hell is this war about after 9/11? That makes no sense.
Yeah.
And we lost our standing, et cetera, et cetera. And so don't you think it's Trump? And Trump is all about his own personal, you know, pride and ego, you know, first and foremost. Don't you think that's, are those the two reasons you think that Trump says what he does?
That makes sense. And he should have, man, he missed the boat by, he had the perfect opportunity to say, I'm the best. I've pulled our troops out. These wars were from Barack Obama and George Bush. These guys are losers. I'm bringing the troops home because I love our military. He had the perfect opportunity to do that. And I think he blew that one.
Well, he did try to, didn't he try to pull the troops out of Afghanistan and the Democrats blocked him?
Yeah. And then he thought he did pull some out of Syria, and the behind his back, they put more back or something like that. It shows you how much power the military industrial complex.
No, the chief envoy to Syria, the American envoy, lied to Trump about how many troops there were in Syria. That was the scandal. It was incredible. The commander in chief, you lied to the commander in chief about how many of our troops are on the ground in a foreign country. And that's okay.
Right.
Yeah, it is, because it was a year ago and nothing's happened to the guy, and there's not even, no one talks about it anymore. I mean, that's like, that's treason. That's treason, really bad treason, because it extended a war that no one wants.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's what it did. Buck, you work for the government.
Yeah.
Mr. Libertarian, Mr. The state is the monopoly on violence and can do no good. Or is that what you do you not think that?
So to do what I do, I have a passion for it. There's no other option. And in my old defense, I got into it before I was considering myself an ANCAP, way before that.
Right.
But I can't fight fire and pull people out of burning buildings and do CPR on people and save their lives privately. There just doesn't exist. So I have to do it this way. I wish it weren't the case. And I've thought about doing some papers on the way to privatize the fire department, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. And I have other political interests outside of the fire stuff. I mean, I certainly can think of models on how it would work, but you know, it doesn't work that way. And so to do it, I've got to, unfortunately, get paid by taxes.
I want to hear more about what it's like to be a firefighter. I'm just really curious. But before we do that, do you know about the history of private firefighting companies?
You told me a long time ago. Yeah, we spoke about it and I cannot remember it. Does that have to do with insurance companies?
No, it's an amazing story. People who want to get a really quick hit on this can just go watch Gangs of New York, the movie. Because that it's in there. So before the Civil War, there were almost no public fire companies in the country. They were all private. So in New York and Philadelphia and Boston, cities like that, there were multiple competing fire companies, and they were organized around ethnicity. So there were Irish fire companies, and there were Protestant WASP fire companies, and they would often be associated with gangs, and the fire companies with their gangs would often have these pitched battles in the streets. But the other funny thing was that anytime a fire broke out, there was a race. They had to race to the fire, and whichever one got there first got to put out the fire and got paid.
We still do that.
Oh, really? You guys compete?
Oh, it's very common. Of course, it doesn't matter who gets paid. We all get paid the same. But oh, yeah, it's very common to do it as fast as you can. And you're always cognizant of which other engine company's nearby. Where's the address at? Who's closer? We got to get there first. Oh, really? Oh, yes.
Just for pride, though?
Oh, well, the people that get there first have the most fun because you get to go directly inside the burning building.
Oh, the action. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, you guys like the action. Okay, I want to talk about that. But yeah, So, and then what happened was, of course, the government started to take over and started to professionalize the fire companies. And then they made it illegal to have a private fire company. This is mid 19th century, around the time of the Civil War. And it's been, I don't know if it's actually, I'm not sure it's, it must be illegal, but yeah, essentially that became the case. So, but after World War II, state had a monopoly and that's that ever since then. But for many, many years, they operated and competed against each other. And, you know, I don't know exactly how efficient and effective they were, but the model, now the fighting in the streets, that's the thing you got to work out. You got to figure out how to avoid that. The gang warfare.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think it could happen. I wonder if you could just start doing it. Why is there anything to stop you from just being a private firefighter and like having a private group that you fight fires with, and you could be on call in a particular like neighborhood or town? And it's not illegal for you to operate that way, is it?
Not that I know of. For one, it would be expensive.
Yeah, to have your own engine.
Yeah, and to just the overhead is, you know, those engines are expensive.
Yeah,
you know, they break constantly. Mm-hmm. It's interesting you asked that. I need to think about that, because I know like in apartment complexes, they'll have someone say who works for San Antonio Police Department, an apartment complex. Well, he's their on-duty security guards, and that's basically private, and he gets free rent.
Yeah. Exactly.
So he's kind of doing that. I guess you can do that in a sense, but for fire, yeah, here's our fire engine. Can we live here for free?
Why not?
Maybe I should try that on my street.
I mean, I'm serious. I think you should think about this. I think it's actually a possibility to do it on a small scale, but you just have to do it at all effectively to serve as a model, right? And as an example, and you can just say, well, it is possible now. And then maybe other people will emulate it. But I want you to do that. I want you to have your own company.
Yeah, I'd be awesome at it, of course.
I know. Yeah. And just don't fight the rival Irish fire company down the road. Yeah.
The Asian firefighters.
So yeah, man. So let's talk about, I really want to hear about firefighting. I told you before we started recording, I think I've been friends with only one other firefighter and we never really talked about it. So you've done it since you were 19. And you've loved it. It sounds like you really love firefighting.
It's great.
Tell me why.
Because for one, of what it's not. So I would not be good at sitting at a desk, at a cubicle, and doing that kind of 9-to-5 work. It's just not my thing. Mainly because I've never done it. So, you know, when people come at me with, "Hey, could you send this spreadsheet or something?" In the podcast world, I don't know what that is really. And I do, but I don't know how to make them. And so it's just, it's unique, it's different, and it's very much a family vibe at the fire station. So you're close with all of these people. You live together every third day for 24 hours and you kind of work out, you get paid to eat and sleep sometimes, hopefully. But yeah. And just to, then it's rewarding, of course, to do the actual work of it. To pull someone out of a house that is on fire and they live. Pretty neat thing.
How many times have you done that? Pulled someone out of a house?
One, two, three in my career.
You pulled people out of a burning house.
Yes. One was an apartment. One was a garage apartment. One was a normal, regular apartment. And the last one was a house. Yes.
Tell me the stories. What? Tell me the first.
You cut out one more time.
Damn.
The first one was the coolest one.
Yeah,
that was the best one. She was close to my age at the time. It was right around the corner from my station. It was a upstairs garage apartment, and my partner went. It was full of smoke in there. My partner went in without his air mask because he just thought, "I'll go in real quick before the hose gets up here." The fire hose wasn't charged. And he comes back out coughing. He goes, "There's too much smoke," but there's a really loud snoring noise directly straight on just to the right in the back. Mm. Well, while he was in there, I was putting my air mask on. I was actually getting prepared. And so I went in there and I could hear this loud snoring respirations. And it's weird because for those that do like Brazilian jiu-jitsu and boxing, you might've heard the kind of snoring someone does when they're out or close to death or knocked out cold. It's different than the kind they do when they're sleeping.
Oh,
so it's unmistakable. And I heard this loud, that kind of snoring, and it was so much smoke. I had to get down with inches of her face, and it was just black stuff coming all out of her nose and mouth. And I was young, and I had only been on the job like 3 or 4 years. So my initial instinct, I thought it looked like someone beat her up. But whatever the case, I started picking her up, and she was ended up being 6'1", it's pretty damn tall. I'm like, where does she end? I'm trying to pick her up. And my partner then comes back in with his mask all assembled. Then so we both took her out, and then they took her down the stairs and resuscitated her in the ambulance. They told her, I don't know how they know this, but the doc said that she was 9 seconds away from death. But who knows? And then her and I became friends after that.
Really?
I went to her house. She would throw parties, and she'd always have me over. She was at the award ceremony. You get awards if you do that, save someone. She was there and spoke at it and kind of cried. It was very sweet. And like I said, she was probably 4 years older than me. So it was kind of neat. You know, it's like someone that you see out and about who's close to your age. You know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, man. How did that feel? You were a young guy. You were in your 20s, right?
Yeah. My 20s. And my captain at the time was like, he goes, I've been doing this job, I don't know, 25 or 30 years, and I've never had a save. He goes, so relish this. This might be like the only one you get in your entire career. He's like, this is a pretty cool deal. So, yeah.
How often do you run into her?
It's been a few years now. It was back when I was in my 20s and going out constantly in Austin, probably every couple months I'd see her.
Really? And she would just light up, I'm sure, when she saw you, right?
Oh yeah. She'd buy me drinks. She'd kiss my face, hug on me. Yeah. She was very sweet.
You saved her life. She should be. That's amazing. All right. Tell the second story.
The second one, it's funny because we have a lot of fire departments are known, at least the ones in big cities, for having calls on homeless people. Mm-hmm. Probably certainly the ones around Oakland. Oh, yeah. And this was a guy that we had made many times that was homeless. Well, somehow he got up on his feet for a brief moment and was able to afford an apartment. And we got there and popped the door open, and the smoke billowed out. And we do this thing called a blind sweep, where when you first pop a door, the place is burning, you get down low and sweep with your hands really quick before you go in there with water, just to feel, because victims are always near doorways. They're trying to get out and they'll usually just collapse because they can't make it. And so he was right there. I felt him. I did a blind sweep and I felt this guy. I was like, oh shit, he's right here. So we pull him out. And I was like, son of a bitch, that's that bum guy that we always make calls on. So I guess he's got an apartment now. And so, yeah, that was the second one.
Amazing.
The third one was just 2 years ago. I can't show you the award, because it's got the fire department name on it, but I just got the award like a week ago because the award process slowed down over COVID year. That was a cool one too. That was at a house fire. And I had a firefighter with me that was, I was very close friends with. And, I had been an instructor in her fire academy. And so I got out of the fire academy. She was graduated it, and we ended up on the same unit, and I was in charge. And we were doing what they call a recon, where you go around the house, and I was showing her what we're looking for and everything. And I said, you know, one of the things we do is pop the back door while the companies are all going in the front, because again, that's where the victims are. And the door had been popped by another company, but they didn't keep checking, so they kept going. And I said, here's the door, it's open, and looked down. I was like, son of a bitch, there's a guy right here. And so he was doing the same thing. He tried to make it to the door. It was a hoarder house, so there was stuff all in the hallway leading to the door.
Oh my God.
Yeah. We see a lot of those, and he didn't quite make it. And, she was badass. She's like, I got him. Radio to the chief. We got a victim. So yeah. And then we pulled him out.
Three. You've done this three times.
Yeah.
That's a lot, right?
It's a lot. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought that, but yeah, my captain 20 years ago was like, you might never get this ever again.
Now, you, of course, have no feelings about this because, you know what, Buck? I don't know if you know this about libertarians. They don't care about people.
Some of them don't. That's for sure.
You can say the same thing about socialists.
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, no, really. So you have a job that's absolutely, it's about caring about people, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's the irony. Over the years, some leftists that I've known have said, thrown language at me like, you just don't care about people, or, you know, all of the typical stuff that lefties throw at libertarians. And I just, it's just funny, like, if you only knew.
Yeah. Yeah. You would have, you could have just left those three people to die in those houses.
Yes, exactly. But, yeah. And usually the people throwing those charges at me have never done anything close to something like that. So,
okay. So let me throw a very different left-wing charge at you. So firefighting, why it actually does seem to me to be something that the government at least doesn't do poorly, does it? Like,
I would agree. Yeah. Okay. And throughout the years I've thought about it deeply, and I work with people that also, I have worked with people that consider themselves ANCAPs and libertarians. And we've discussed these things along the lines of course, how else could we do this, et cetera. But then also, every organization has their flaws, private for sure. Lots of private organizations have their flaws. But this fire department that I work for, there's things, of course, that I don't like. There's all that, again, that's any organization, especially libertarians. We're always going to find something to fight, but it's pretty good at what it does, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the camaraderie, man, I really get that. Although I guess it could backfire. You could end up in a station in a house where you don't like the guys, but I mean, I've heard it described as almost like a second family. Is that accurate?
100%.
100%. Why is that?
That's just because if you work every third day, it's a third of your life, essentially, is what, how everyone qualifies that. And you're with them in and out, and you're doing tasks and put in situations that normal people will never experience. Yeah. And so there's a bit of that, like, well, we did this together. And so you kind of develop bonds through things like that as well.
Mm-hmm. So you are very close to these guys and women too, I suppose.
Yeah. My crew. Now I have two women. I'm in charge, by the way. So, when I say my crew, I have two women.
What does that mean? What's your title?
Lieutenant.
Oh, really? So you're in charge of what?
Of one fire engine, and we're the only fire engine at my fire station. So essentially I'm in charge of the fire station on my shift.
Okay.
Gotcha. So I'm in charge. Basically I'm the boss of these two women and two men that work with me.
Oh, wow. And do they know about your politics and your podcast and all this?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And what do they think?
These people in particular, this grouping, I think they think it's neat. You know, I know one of them listens to it from time to time. The other ones may or may not. I don't know. They've never said, but I think they think it's kind of a cool project that I do on the side.
What does your dad think?
He likes it now. I was, he is not one to be overly warm, maybe, with his feelings and overly complimentary throughout the years. He's growing in that regard. He's getting better at it, but when I put the Ron Paul episode out that I did, I was shocked. He posted it on Facebook and said, I'm so proud of my son and for doing this. And as someone who's been a lifelong conservative and used to question Ron Paul, I have to admit he's pretty much been right on everything.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
Look what you did, Buck.
You know what? Who else did? It was Donald Trump somehow. Because he got my dad to be anti-war.
No way.
Yes. It's not like my dad's going to go march in an anti-war protest, but he certainly now thinks these wars were a waste of time and lives and money, and that it was a giant mistake. He's told me that many times because Trump says it. And not just that he's just a blind follower. I think he kind of, at this point, it helps to hear a public figure that you respect say it, but you might have been thinking it along the way. It's been 20 years in Afghanistan. Come on. So he's finally on that page. And so he hears Ron Paul speak. And when he used to call him kooky and weird, now he's going, he was right.
You know, I mean, I'm assuming your dad is not alone. I'm sure. I know. We know that there are many, many thousands of old school conservatives, just like your dad, who became at least partly anti-war because Trump was running around the country giving anti-war speeches half the time. You know, yep. There's that famous speech. Was it a debate in South Carolina during the, was it when he just gave a straight up anti-war, anti-imperialist
during the primaries
in South Carolina. South freaking Carolina.
Cheered.
Yeah, Republicans in South Carolina.
You will not hear one anti-war statement at a Biden rally, not one, but you could hear him at Trump rallies.
They don't talk about war one way or the other at Biden rallies. It's a non-issue. They don't care.
No.
It's incredible how little they care.
It has nothing to do with identity politics. Yeah.
Yeah. It's only if it's a racist war would they care.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, just to get back to this thing, like about Trump changing people like that on such an important issue. I argue it is the most important issue because it is the worst thing that governments can do. And it's the most power that presidents have, et cetera, et cetera. And we live in a superpower that can go to war anytime it wants. And it often does. For someone who adored Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley and probably Ronald Reagan to call into question those wars, that is a major contribution to American politics and culture by Donald Trump.
Yes, I could not agree more. Yeah,
and I never thought of that until you just said this.
Yeah, I saw it firsthand. So I was always thinking, at least, you know, Trump's not ending wars, which we would all like him to. He's not Ron Paul. We can all agree on that. But he's certainly making people like my parents realize the errors of the ways of going to unnecessary wars overseas.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the whole MAGA crowd, they are 100% consistent on this stuff. They are opposed to regime change wars. They're opposed to the existing wars. They want them to end right away. And they're the only anti-war movement in this goddamn country.
Yeah.
I mean, that has any potential to hold office, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, so were you... You must have been doing some sort of rebellion against your dad by choosing the politics that you did, especially early on when you were a reason type guy, a rock and roll libertarian.
Yeah.
Was it consciously that for you?
Yeah, a little bit, maybe halfway, because not just my dad, although maybe he represented some part of it, but I would listen to Rush Limbaugh sometimes on the way to work, just kind of out of curiosity. And then I would work with Republicans that backed George Bush. And so hearing the libertarian platform and philosophy, it's like, I just wanted to slap these people and wake them up. Like, how could you be for George Bush and the wars? Like, that's big government. Don't you see this? It's intervention overseas is just as bad, if not worse, as intervention at home. Right. It's the same thing. It's, you know, Wilsonian, but yeah, so that stuff drove me crazy. And it's just like there was some type of, maybe rebellion against that kind of stuff. But it just seemed the first time I read libertarian stuff when I was young, I was like, how could you not agree with this? At least it's so consistent. And I would try to tell my dad, like, this is what real conservatism should be. Small government, out of the wars, no drug. The drug laws hurt people, Dad. That's big government. Why would you want to do that? You know,
right. Yeah, you should turn them on to the old right, the old Republicans, the isolationists, you know, Robert Taft and all those cats, man. They were amazing. I was about to say the best. They weren't I will say that. For me, according to my values, in the history of America, in American political history, American political party history, that stuff, they're definitely my favorite politicians in American, which isn't saying much because I hate all of them, but you know.
Right.
If you go read those isolationists back in the 1930s, oh my God, they were heroic and genius and like right and completely correct.
Yes.
And so heroic. Turn them on to that.
Prophets on the Right.
I was going to tell you that book. I was just going to say that book. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That's what it reminded me of when you were saying that.
By Ronald Radosh.
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. I think it said forward by Murray. Yeah. I think the forward's by Rothbard even. I can't remember.
Yeah. I think so. That might be right. Yeah. Everybody should go read Prophets on the Right by Ronald Radosh. He profiles like how many, like three or four of those guys I just described, this old right, the anti-interventionist right of the mid 20th century. Robert Taft has a whole chapter in there.
Yep.
Yeah. Eugene Dennis has another chapter in there. That whole history that your friends in the paleo movement, you know, like the dear departed Justin Raimondo is another great example, right? That's who they were aware of. That's who they considered to be their godfathers. And Pat Buchanan is part of that lineage too. It's quite heroic, and it's been like swept under the rug by everybody, but especially the Republican Party, who wants to distance itself from that past. They were among the greatest anti-war activists in world history. There's no question about it, because they were standing as United States senators and congresspeople and governors right dead center in the middle of the superpower as the superpower is emerging and saying no.
Yes.
Saying no to that whole project. They lost, in case, case people are wondering. But yeah, I mean, that's for people like your dad, that's who you should, you know, turn them on to. Say, Dad, read this speech by this senator from Ohio named Taft back in the 1950s, you know? Yep. So I want to hear about your podcast. I want to hear your favorite moments, your biggest moments. I know a few of them, but what have been for you the most exciting moments for you in your podcast? Because you've interviewed some pretty big names and people who really mean a lot to you.
Yes. The one that stands above all of them, I would have to say, is Lou Rockwell. I've interviewed him twice. The last one I did with him is my favorite of all time, probably. And it was leading up to the election. And I said, Lou, there's a lot of people listening, because if you remember that, well, everyone listening, up in the libertarians were split. Do we vote for Jo Jorgensen? She's nothing. Like, she's just an empty suit. She doesn't motivate anyone. Do we vote for Donald Trump? I don't know. That's kind of weird too. It's a major party figure. We're not used to doing something like that. And of course, there's going to be things we don't like about him. Are we being inconsistent to pull the lever for Trump? And I said, Lou, there's a lot of people listening that are unsure what to do. Do we go with the Libertarian Party? What do we do in this situation? I said, I know, sir, that you don't vote, but do you have any advice for people? And he just cuts me off and he goes, you got to do the right wing thing. That's what you got to do. If you vote at all, you need to vote for Trump. And I didn't do video at the time. So I stood up and I was like, oh my God, I got Lou Rockwell to say something so cool like this, because a lot of libertarians wouldn't straight up say something like that. And Lou said it without missing a beat.
I know that Lou supported Trump twice, right? And voted for him.
He didn't vote.
He did not vote, really, but I heard him say many, 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 many positive things about Trump. So many that it sounded to me like he was a Trump supporter. He is, isn't he?
Yeah. He, when I spoke with him in person a few months ago, he said, he blamed the Libertarian Party for costing Trump the election. And he said, I certainly have it was interesting to hear him. And he said, I certainly have my problems with Donald Trump. I think Lou's actual quote was, but he's not the monster that we have in the White House right now.
This is true. For those who don't know, Lou Rockwell heads up the Mises Institute, which is one of the, I consider it to be sort of one of the major wings of the libertarian movement.
Yes.
Mises, who's sort of the hardcore anarcho-capitalist, very interested in economics, sometimes to the exclusion of other issues, which is just fine, but that's their focus. And they've also been accused of being not so great on race and gender. And that's the crew that's been associated with the Ron Paul newsletter. So that's their scandal. But they've trained generation after generation after generation of libertarian intellectuals and activists who have really been central in the movement, whether you like it or not. You can't deny that the Mises Institute has been important. Also in economics, I happen to agree with everything they say.
To answer really quick,
there's
stuff I know about Lou Rockwell personally that I won't say and I shouldn't say out of respect for him. But those race charges, I can tell you firsthand.
Yeah.
Hard facts that I know for 100% certainty, I would not agree with those.
Yeah? What do you mean? What do you mean agree with what?
The charge is that he's, you know, there's people that say he's racist and stuff like that. He's done things in his life that I will not divulge because he's a private person, that if everyone that throws those charges against him would know, they would go, oh, I guess I was wrong.
Okay.
I'll just say that. I'll tell you about the air, Thad.
Okay. Yeah. I'll just say this. I'm pretty familiar with his work, and I've read him and I've listened to him many, many times. I've never seen or read anything that I would consider even racist adjacent. I mean, not at all, nothing. He tends just not to talk about race. The Mises people tend not to, they just tend to avoid it. Tom Woods, who's part of that crowd too. They just don't talk about race. But I will just say, so people know, like, he's been accused by some of being the author of the infamous Ron Paul racist newsletter of 1979, was it? Yeah. That's just so people know that. I have no idea if it was him. But you're saying to me, not only did Lou Rockwell not author the Ron Paul newsletters, but he is definitely, in your mind, not a racist?
The second part, for sure, he's not a racist in my mind. And okay. I have what I would consider credible information, though I did not get this from Lou Rockwell himself, that he did not do that. And I've been told by multiple sources who did do it.
Oh,
and it's someone who's not associated with the Mises Institute any longer.
Then I think, can we say this? Can you say it now? Can you say who it is?
I'd rather not.
Why not?
Well, because I don't know for a fact, because it's just been told to me by people that I would seem to find credible, but I don't know it for a fact. And that's a pretty shitty charge to level against someone.
It is. Yeah. I think I know who it is now. That's interesting. Okay. We'll have to talk afterward. All right. So Lou Rockwell, you're a big fan. And that was exciting. And you got him to say stuff that you can't get normal libertarians to say. And what other moments have been especially meaningful for you?
Well, as it turns out, now that I'm doing what I'm doing, certainly being on this show, the podcast that I had with you, where when you were done, you kept reaching out to me and saying, well, my girlfriend said this is the best she's ever heard me. It was so interesting, because when I wrote you, I was just kind of throwing it out there. Like, we'll see. Somehow you accepted my friend request. Well, let's see if he writes back. And then you're like, yeah, let's do it. I was like, holy shit, Thad's going to do this. And so the fact that kind of spurred what is now the Counterflow podcast, that was obviously is giant for me. And then how complimentary you were afterwards. And so that was big in my life. And then every conversation with Jeff Deist, I now consider him a friend. He's been very helpful and a resource that I can always reach out to if I need to.
He's actually technically the head of the Mises Institute, right?
He's the president.
He's the president.
Lou Rockwell's the founder.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Jeff's an old punk rock guy too, from Orange County, was in a punk band.
Huh.
Yes. And so he's got those roots. He drove my wife and I around the city when we were down there at the Mises Institute. And he took us to lunch. Very awesome guy. And he always makes me think, Thaddeus Russell, Jeff Deist, and Michael Malice, and now maybe Curtis Yarvin, always get my mind working. And you guys all have interesting perspectives and make me go, I didn't even think of it like that.
Huh.
So Jeff's in that category, and I always like having him on to talk. I've had friends on too, like musicians. My friend, the Reverend Horton Heat, has been on. My friend Dale Watson, Big Sandy. So it's neat to get friends from the music scene onto your show. We talked about politics of sorts over the lockdown time. Mm-hmm. So those are neat experiences. And certainly when you reach out to Ron Paul and you're looking at your email one day and you get a response with Dr. Paul would love to be on your show, that was one of the moments I'll never forget as well.
I bet.
Yeah. And then certainly interviewing him, and it's sweet. It's Ron Paul, and we're used to doing these Zoom sessions, and I called his office, and that's what we recorded over that line. And he just answers, "This is Ron," like we're in the 70s or something.
Wow.
So that was charming. He's amazing. And he's the best congressman in the history of America, in my opinion. So that was great too.
Mm. Yeah. What gave you the idea to start a podcast?
I was listening to some, and I thought I was listening to, politically, I was listening to Tom Woods and Jason Stapleton. And then I think that filtered into Dave Smith. And I thought, you know what? My best friend owns a studio. If I could talk to him about microphone stuff and recording stuff, maybe I could slightly convince some of my music friends that are lefties of this stuff that they just don't have access to, or they just don't know. If I can lay these principles out to the left-wing music community, they're all going to be libertarians. And boy, was I wrong. But in the process, I've got to, as I transition to more of an interview style show rather than solo, I've now it's like, why would I stop doing this? I get to interview people that I respect, and authors and journalists and people that have run for office and everything. It's the best thing in the world. I love it outside of, you know, my job, my family and whatnot. But yeah, now I don't want to stop. So meeting, you know, I wouldn't have met you. I wouldn't have been in Oregon. I would have gone to the Mises Institute function that Jeff invited me to. So it's just, it's been amazing. And yeah, I just started it thinking I could maybe convince a few lefties to us that the libertarian ideas were the ones to go with.
How's that going?
Not well. In fact, some of them, as my podcast started getting bigger, I noticed that they were lashing out harder at me. So that's interesting.
Oh God. Yeah. It's a lost cause. So
yes, it is.
So we're going to do something very, very amazing and fun in October at your house in Lockhart. Cause you have, you have an acre spread, I hear, there. And we're going to have the Renegade University weekend, October 8th to the 10th. And we have this lineup that has just never been seen before. All the RU weekends until now have had one, at most two special guests. We have five for this one, including Buck and me. So it's actually seven of us who will be speaking and on stage. Let's talk about these guests. So we have Scott Horton. He's been on your show, right?
Yep, several times. Yep.
Tell me, like, in one or two sentences, just who is Scott Horton to you? Like, what does he represent? What does he mean?
He is the best foreign policy mind that I've ever encountered, ever heard, or listened to in any on any platform. His brain is something special, and he's been nothing but friendly and amazing to me since my podcast was nothing. He's always agreed to appear. I told him he's got a punk rock ethos, meaning it's just such a, of course, man, I'm one of you, when we all know, like, he's above us. At least I think that. But he will approach you like he's one of you. And he's just an amazing person. He's a very kind and brilliant mind. I'll tell you one quick story.
Yeah.
I was dealing with someone that was going to be a guest. And this guest said, can you please send me all the questions you're going to ask? I sent them. Oh, can we switch the? And then I got like you send something to a freaking editor. And this guest said this, scratch this, add this. And then the guest said, in fact, make it next week. Oh, Scott, you know, I want to do a show on Joe Biden's foreign policy. Yeah, let's do it. Boom. Totally. I start talking to him right before we start. I go, hey, man, so I'm just going to ask you. And he goes, you don't have to prep me. Ask me whatever you want. And I was like, what a fucking refreshing change that is. Yeah. Someone who's smart enough and confident in what they know that they don't need to be prepped. And then not only that, I threw in a random question on the CIA at the end, and the dude act like he had been studying for the question. Insane. I've never seen someone whose brain works like his. It's brilliant.
Yeah, he is. His body of knowledge, the breadth and depth of his knowledge on U.S. foreign policy is I'm pretty sure it's unsurpassed, because even people who are academics in international relations, you know, who specialize in this, they tend to have particular fields of, you know, expertise. So they'll be experts on one region. Usually, you know, it's usually they'll be experts on Europe and NATO and the EU, or they're experts on the Middle East and the war on terror, or they're experts on East Asia, North Korea and China, you know. But Scott does all of it. He has people on his show, and has had people on his show, I think it's now about 20 years, who cover the gamut. I mean, of course, there's much more talk about the Middle East and NATO because those are where things are happening. But he's discussed every part of the damn globe on his show multiple times. And he has to become essentially an expert on every field in every region, which is astonishing. I've been writing a book about foreign policy, as you know, the history of it, you know, for many years now. And it's the reason it's taken me a decade to write this book is that when you do foreign policy and you're doing American foreign policy, that means you've got to learn the history and the politics and the culture of every other goddamn country, because the United States has pretty much invaded every other country in some way or another. If not an actual boots on the ground invasion, the United States has had people and influence in these places. So, yeah, so Scott's amazing and an incredible resource. And then we have Cody Wilson. Have you ever had Cody on your show?
No, I'd like to, though. I've always, I was going to reach out to him, and then he got in a bit of trouble right around that time. So I wasn't able to, and I have not yet, but I would love to.
You should. Yeah. So Cody's going to be at this, and Cody's an absolute genius. And he's one of the very few libertarians who's also a postmodernist, which is one of the reasons I like him. But he's much more known for his 3D printed guns fame. He's actually very famous, and he's been on 60 Minutes. He's been on major sort of cable news shows and even network broadcast shows infamously, you know, but he's the one who essentially started 3D printed guns, and he's the hero of that. And at RU, we actually have a course on 3D printed guns, and we used Cody as a consultant on that. So, but he's a really brilliant, really fascinating guy who can talk on a wide range of subjects. And how about, let's see, who else have you, is Hotep?
I need Hotep on my show.
Yeah.
I need Husky on my show. I have not had Jack the Perfume Nationalist. I need all the only one I've had is you and Scott.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to tell you, you got to have all these people. So Jack the Perfume Nationalist, you've got to have him on your show. He's from Texas. He's a conservative. He's gay. He's brilliant. He's, you know, he's interested in culture much more than, you know, you are, but I think that would be a tremendous pairing actually between the two of you.
Yeah. I like cologne, so.
And he's and he and you smell good, and he's really, really brilliant and so funny. He's so funny. Hotep, Jesus, too. People, I don't have to talk about him.
Yeah.
So he'll, these guys will all be there. And then Deirdre McCluskey, who, my goodness gracious, Deirdre, I don't know how many books has she written, something like 10 or 12 or something like that. And she has like three of those books is this like sweeping trilogy on the history of Europe and bourgeois culture. And she makes a very elaborate argument in defense of bourgeois virtues. In fact, that's what she calls it. And of course, Thaddeus Russell has done just the opposite. So when we talk, it's a very interesting sort of tension there, but I love her. And she's one of my very favorite people and incredibly generous and kind. And, but the thing about Deirdre, her, speaking of breadth of knowledge, think about if Scott Horton knew that much about everything, about every field. I mean, that's Deirdre. She knows history. She knows economics. She knows politics. She knows philosophy. She knows the 17th century, the 18th century, the 19th century. I mean, she's something else, and she's going to be there as well. So, and oh, she's also trans and has the best trans politics I've ever encountered, which is just like, yeah, I was born in the wrong body and I wanted to be a woman and I'm a woman and I've never looked back and I'm completely comfortable with it. And that's it. I don't care what you call me. I don't care what pronouns you use. That's that, you know, and I don't need you to think any particular way about me or trans people. I don't care. I just know who I am. I have found her to be like so healthy on that and such a great intervention.
I've got one of her books that was written before, I guess she changed. It's got her former name on it.
I think it is it Donald? Yeah, Donald.
Yeah.
Donald McCluskey. Yeah, really?
Yeah, I got it because I like old books and I saw that on Amazon. I thought I'll get her now to autograph this one. Be kind of cool.
Yeah, for Deirdre to autograph Donald's book.
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome. So yeah, man. And the fact that it's in Lockhart, which is, so do you eat barbecue a lot? Like it's famous for barbecue.
I try not to overindulge because I don't want to get sick of it, but man, it's good. And so it probably once every 2 weeks I'll eat it.
Which there's three famous barbecue places like walking distance from your house, which is, that's like, maybe that might be the thing I'm most excited about. So which one has the best brisket? That's all I want to know.
They're all pretty close. That's the thing. As far as brisket and sausage, Kreitz, Black's, and Smitty's all are pretty damn close.
Yeah.
So okay. I judge them by the sides. Good. And so I like Black's the best because they have the best sides, in my opinion. So, because the meat's all pretty similar, the brisket's all amazing. If for people that don't know, Texas barbecue's heavily brisket based, rather than pork like in Tennessee and stuff. So yeah, it's damn good. You got to get the moist cut brisket because it's got all the fat juices.
The Friday night VIP dinner at your house will be catered by Blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't wait. Yeah, I got him. Like, I'm so. It's been hilarious how excited I've been about the food. But I have a special love of barbecue. Well, my friend, my brother, my colleague in the Renegade Media Network, it's been a great pleasure not just talking to you today, but being your friend for the last year.
Yes, thank you. This has been an amazing step forward for me, and it's all thanks to you. So I'm thankful for you and glad to be on this show. I've been listening to it so often. Now I get to be on it. So pretty cool.
Here you are, man. Thank you.
Thanks,
Dad. All right, Buck. We'll talk soon.
Yes, sir.
Peace.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.